Mike, I love physics so much. It's my favorite class. I wish I could learn more.
OMG, Claire, I know the perfect solution.
Really, Mike? Tell me more.
Two words. Physics in action.
It sounds thrilling already.
Oh, Claire, it gets even better. Let me tell you all about it. Silly Beagle Production presents Physics in Action, a podcast which showcases physics in everyday world, reaching beyond the scopes of standard textbook. Each episode brings you applications and analysis of physics in such diverse settings as sports, movies, video games, and television. We also take a look into the frontier of physics exploration. And don't forget the interviews with exciting personalities on the leading edge of physics innovation and application. So join us for our trip into the fantastic world of physics. Don't forget, you can find us on our podcast on iTunes stores under Physics in Action. And check out our website, physicsinaction.com.
It sounds so cool, Mike. I'll check it out.
Good.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Physics in Action podcast. I'm your host, Sarah.
And I'm Sam.
And we've got quite an episode for you today. We'll begin with a look at the physics of interstellar travel with Jake, then switch gears as Dustin talks about the technology and physics behind railguns.
Now we're going to take it to Jake's segment about interstellar travel.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Jake, here for Physics in Action to talk to you about interstellar travel. Now, I'm sure you've all seen Star Trek, and if you haven't, well, I definitely recommend it. But the ships that they've built in the future, the far future, travel in between planets and stars like it's no big deal. Jump into warp 5, punch it, you know, that's Star Trek for you. But in the real world, obviously, we haven't been able to develop a spacecraft yet that can travel to a nearby star cluster, like I think Andromeda's maybe 4 light-years away or something like that. Maybe it's probably a lot larger. Don't mind my lack of facts. I've got some later. Anyway, what I'm going to be talking to you about is interstellar travel and some ideas that people have come up with for spaceships that could feasibly travel to other star systems within like the lifetime of a crew member. Maybe not, you know, necessarily the same for people on Earth. But anyway, we'll get to that right about now. The first idea is like an ion engine. Now, an ion engine, if you look at it, is kind of pathetic, because if you put it on a tabletop, it couldn't even move. But it could operate for more than years, because what it does is it takes, you know, small ions, just atoms, and charges them and shoots them out the back. And because it shot something out the back, like Newton's third law, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So shooting an ion out of the back will make it move forward. Now, ions don't weigh very much, but an ion engine launched in 1998 fired for a total of 678 days. Now, that's more than a year. So eventually, they really get going. It's not fast, but it'll get you there. So that's one of the ideas. And the second idea is a solar sail, which is based on a principle that Kepler discovered in 1611, because sunlight exerts a very small pressure, which obviously is enough to propel a gigantic sail through space. It's the same principle as like a sailboat with the wind, except for sunlight would be like the wind for your solar sail. Now, the idea is that we'd have to build a gigantic sail, and some people have theorized that it would have to be miles long, hundreds of miles across. You'd have to build it in outer space, because you can't really launch something that large without it, you know, getting damaged. And also, an idea is to build lasers on the moon for this sail, so that we could shoot the lasers at the sail to get it to speed up, because, you know, light exerts the pressure and whatnot. The problem with the solar sail is obviously the construction of something hundreds of miles across, and that the lasers would kind of have to have, like, 1,000 times the current total output of the planet Earth. We don't really have that kind of power anywhere nearby. Anywhere, to be honest. Can't power it with oil. stuff like that. So here's another idea called the ramjet. The ramjet is a very good idea, in my opinion. But it's based on the principle of, you know, nuclear fusion, like, you know, like an H-bomb works. So you could, and there's hydrogen all over the universe. It's the most abundant element because it's just, you know, a nucleus is a proton and it's orbited by one electron, mostly. And then, so the principle behind a ramjet is that it would be powered by hydrogen fusion. And as it's coasting along through space, it would have a scoop to pick up more hydrogen. So they would theoretically be able to travel anywhere where there's hydrogen because, I mean, there's fuel all around it. If a ramjet engine could accelerate, like, for 1G, which is standing on the surface of the Earth, you experience 1G. If it could do that for 1 year, which I guess isn't that much of a problem, the ramjet could reach 77% of the speed of light, which is rather fast. I don't have the exact number. But after accelerating at 1G for 11 years, the spacecraft would reach the star cluster that's 400 light years away. The 11 years would be for the person inside the starship, not, you know, outside, where it would be probably thousands of years for Earth. That, of course, you know, it's a nice idea. It sounds great. But the problem is that when most bombs use fusion, they use a special isotope of hydrogen that's heavier. But most hydrogen isn't that heavy. So it might not be powered as efficiently as a lot of people hoped. But, you know, it's still a good idea. And who doesn't like the idea of fuel that you don't have to, you know, get at a gas station? That'd be pretty convenient. And the last idea I'm going to talk about with you today is the nuclear pulsed rocket. Now, the nuclear pulsed rocket is a rocket that's powered by nuclear bombs. It's kind of similar to that ramjet we were talking about before. But instead of using the fusion inside, like, the fuel tank, where we shoot out the energy of the back, the nuclear pulsed rocket actually drops a nuclear bomb out of the back of the spaceship, and as it explodes behind them, it pushes them forward, you know, like the shockwave and whatnot. So H-bombs, just like dropping out of the back of a rocket, would be able to shoot it forward, and it would be real nice, but the issue is that our old friend, the Limited Test Ban Treaty, which it says that we can't test nuclear devices, kind of killed off the project for quite some time. So it's not a really favorable idea because, I mean, there's nuclear radiation when you launch it. There's all sorts of issues with the design of the spaceship to be able to withstand a nuclear explosion right behind it. That's, you know, that's kind of a problem. But other than that, it's a feasible idea, just kind of difficult to execute. So that's about all I have for you for today with interstellar travel, spaceships. I think it's fair to assume that you probably won't see the Enterprise flying around with its dilithium chambers anytime soon anyway. But there's plenty of ideas, and I got my data from The Physics of the Impossible by Michio Kaku. He's it's a national bestseller, and if you're interested in this sort of thing, covers topics like teleportation and phasers and force fields and robots and telepathy and parallel universes and time travel and all sorts of things. I mean, if you're really getting interested in physics, it's a bit word heavy, but I would definitely recommend it to all of you who have been paying attention to this interstellar travel. And thank you for listening. I'm Jake. You can physicsinaction.com, Physics in Action on the iTunes Store, which you may have gotten this voice recording from. And hopefully you're interested. If you'd like to email us with questions, you know, physicsinaction.com, like I said before. Anything you want, talk to us. We would be more than happy to listen. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
What's up, nerds? This is Professor Jim Kekelius from the University of Minnesota. I'm the author of The Physics of Superheroes. I was the science consultant for the Watchmen film. And you're listening to Science in Action.
Thanks, Jake. We'll have more on this topic in future episodes as Jake explores the physics of time travel as an extension of this topic in conjunction with a listener feedback inquiry.
For now, however, we have Dustin with his take on the physics of railgun.
This is Dustin with today's episode of Physics Frontiers on the topic of railguns. Now, when most people think of a railgun, they might think of the giant guns that were used during the Civil War along the railways so that they could destroy other advancing armies. But this is not the case at all. The railguns I'm referring to are the electromagnetic guns that are similar to Gauss guns, except for that they are much more simplistic and more work is being done in their field. The way a railgun works is that you take two metal rails and you run them parallel alongside each other. Then you take a projector, what you want to be your projectile, and you lay it across the rails. Now, this has to be something that's both tough and it has to be electrically conductive. Then you pass an electric current through the circuit, which has now been created by the connection of the projectile between the two metal rails. And since, in accordance with the right-hand rule, as the current goes up one rail and down the other, it forms an electromagnetic field around the wires that goes up through the center of the projectile. Since the current is going from left to right through the projectile shoots forward at really high velocities and high accelerations, depending on the current that's passed through. Railguns are especially important to the Navy because these projectiles are, though they're many, most of them, almost all of them, are not explosive because they'd be too volatile since you're passing a current through them. They have large amounts of kinetic energy upon impact, larger than the total amount of energy from an explosive projectile. This can cause large, wide-range destruction. And the Navy has an interest in it because also it's very long range, so you could... They can cover a larger area along the coast rather than have a large number of ships in smaller increments. And to give you some idea of how far a railgun could shoot at the level that the Navy's been testing it, which is around 10 megajoules, and they've reached velocities of about 3,000 meters per second, but they can get to velocities of 5,800 meters per second, which is what we'll be measuring with because they believe they can get it within the year. If they were to achieve such velocities, they could shoot the projectile 2,133 miles. And that, to give you some idea of how far that is, that'd be like shooting a projectile all the way from New York to San Francisco about. And it would take about 14 minutes to get there. Now, imagine if you could defend an entire coastline that was the size of New York to San Francisco with one battleship and the amount of money that it would save the Navy. As one can imagine, some of the problems that might arise from building and operating a railgun would mainly be derived from the vast amounts of friction that would be working against the motion of the projectile. Because when they start reaching those velocities and those accelerations, the friction buildup is massive. Due to the large amounts of friction, the railguns tend to overheat very quickly, and that's been a problem that many of the railgun builders have been dealing with since the creation of railguns, how to cool them effectively and how to make sure that the mu kinetic is small enough on the rails that the projectile can just slide smoothly along with the minimum amount of friction being created and therefore the minimum amount of heat and the energy lost. And this brings me to the next major problem, and that would be the force on the two rails through which the electricity is also running. This is the same Lorentz force that was seen in the projectile, except for that it's on a larger object and there's more electricity running through it because it's each wire's force on the other, with the magnetic field around each wire acts on the other wire. And since they're carrying the electricity in opposite directions, they are pushed apart in accordance with the right-hand rule and Lorentz force. So the problem becomes trying to effectively secure the two metal rails in place so that they don't bow outward during this process. And while the Navy has been good at that sort of thing, they have to be made of very durable material, which isn't always the most frictionless material. Now, the third main problem is that for the operation of just about any railgun, you need a great amount of power and a large amount of current passing through the circuit in a very small amount of time because you need to accelerate the projectile at a very quick pace. This isn't too much of a problem for large stationary railguns, or relatively stationary, such as those used or that are planning to be used on naval battleships. But it's a problem for handheld railguns and things like that need to be more portable because you need a large bank of capacitors arranged in parallel in order to store up the amount of energy needed and then release it all at once. And this is also a problem for carry-on weapons because it's extremely dangerous because there's so much current. Due to all the friction and other errors that cause a loss of electricity and a loss of overall energy, even though the largest railgun to date has been a 10.7 megajoule railgun, you only get a yield of about 40 to 50%. And so it's obvious that there could still be great strides in improving the output of these railguns. Although I've talked a lot about how the Navy could use railguns, it's also important to note that they would be of huge use to any sort of combatant military or naval force, even the Air Force. That a typical railgun, even the lower grade ones, can shoot a 2-kilogram projectile made out of tungsten fast enough that, and with enough kinetic energy, that it can pierce all the way through an armored tank and come out the other side. So this would be of enormous use because they just have so much kinetic energy that there would be ample protection and defense against just about any kind of armored vehicle you can think of. From the information presented in this section, it's evident that railguns would be of huge benefit to just about any military force. Make sure you tune in next week for our new Physics in Action podcast update. This is Dustin signing off.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We're thrilled that you have made our podcast such a success with thousands of downloads and more subscribers every day. As always, we appreciate your feedback and would love to hear what you would like to learn more about. You can leave us feedback on the iTunes webpage by sending an email to physicsandactionpodcast@gmail.com or by leaving a comment on our website at www.physicsandaction.com.
Special thanks to Jeff Myers and For Me to See for our music tech, courtesy of Mevio's Music Alley. You can check it out at music.mevios.com.
See you next time.